Hi, good afternoon. My name is Eileen, and I'm an alcoholic. In fact, I'm Eileen, who's a grateful alcoholic, a really, really, really grateful alcoholic. And if there's anyone sitting out there who's cringing at that, I know exactly how you feel. Because when I first came to AA and I would hear people at meetings say that, it just made me feel like I wanted to throw up. I couldn't believe it. I mean, it really made me sick. I thought that they were saying this because they wanted to sound good or they wanted to impress somebody, but I certainly didn't think anybody was saying it because it was the truth. It's the truth. It's my truth. And not only am I a grateful alcoholic and so happy to be in AA, I really can't think of my life without this. And it didn't start out that way. I thought, you know, who the heck wants to wind up in a church basement with a bunch of people I don't even know, I probably don't like them. And I can't think of a better place to be. So I'm very, very happy to be here today and to share my experience, strength, and hope with you. And my intention and my great prayer is that I will say something and there's one person out there who will hear something that will make the difference for them, because that's what happened for me. I started drinking, I had my first drink, well, not my first drink, but I socially, when I was about 16 years old, and I was at a friend's house. It was right around between Christmas and New Year's, and her mother, there were a few of us girls, and her mother was different than any other mothers that I knew. Her mother had a boyfriend, and they lived above a bar in an apartment, and her mother went out one evening with this boyfriend, and she said, you know, to us, because we were there, she said, you can stay here and have something to drink, and they were drinking old granddad bourbon, and I remembered my parents had parties a lot. My parents were not alcoholic, but there was drinking, and I used to love to go around and sip and smell, actually, what was called, very popular when I was growing up, called highballs, which were like whiskey and ginger ale, and always smelled so great, and I used to love to sip it. And so when Patricia's mother went out, I said, I know how to make these things. I didn't know what I was doing. So I put you know, the whiskey in this thing and ginger ale, and I drank it down like it was soda pop. And I don't think I had too many. I couldn't have, because literally I think I would have died. I got so, so sick. And I don't think I've ever in my whole life ever been as sick as I was that night. And I remember waking, I don't remember too much, except I remember she had a hallway, and I had to hold on to the hallway walking because I was going to fall if I didn't. And then I remember like leaning over out the window, throwing up on the whoever the hell was walking into the liquor store, and then the next morning waking up and wondering how I wound up on the turntable of the record player because the room was spinning. I spent the next day. Well, anyway, that did it for me, and I was never going to drink again. And actually, what happened was, I did drink after that a little bit, and I really never got drunk. There wasn't much drinking in those days, I think, for people like me who were in high school too much. But, you know, I went to college, and I remember we used to go out drinking and dancing, and I don't remember really any trouble with alcohol. I drank normally, and if I went to a party and there wasn't what I wanted to drink there, I wouldn't have anything to drink, or, you know, I just would drink, you know, like everybody else. And this went on for several years. And then something happened. And gradually, this wasn't an overnight experience, but gradually I became, I would get drunk a lot when I was drinking. And, I didn't want to get drunk. I would go to somebody's house or party or whatever, and I'd start drinking, and I didn't want to stop. And I had no idea I would be drinking as much as I was. I just knew that at the end of the night, I would be drunk. And this was happening with more and more regularity. And I had a job working in one point at public relations, and a lot of the times I would take clients out to lunch. And it got to the point where I would not drink at lunch because what was happening was that I didn't want to leave the restaurant. And I would get drunk at lunch, and I would go to the liquor store around the corner from where I worked, and I would buy something, like usually wine, and put it in my coffee mug and drink it. And I didn't think there was anything too unusual with that. And I remember I used to stand at the window looking out at all these other the other office buildings and wondering how many other people were doing this. And, you know, I don't have a horror story, except it's my horror story. I remember going out to California on a business trip, and one of the clients was this commodities group, a fruit and vegetable association. And I had to buy fruits and vegetables for a presentation the next day. And I was in California, and I walked out of a supermarket, and I was very drunk because I had tons of drink at the restaurant. I always drank alone, restaurant and the, you know, little cocktail areas. And I was standing, I'm going through the supermarket, and I'm so drunk. It's like piling all these fruits and vegetables. I was overloaded with this. Went out, paid, and walked out, and there was a ramp that you had to walk down to get to the parking lot. And I'm standing on the top of the ramp, and I'm looking out, and I don't know where my car is. And this man comes over to me, and he says, "What's the matter?" I said, "I can't find my car." And he said, "What kind of car do you have?" And I didn't know, because I rented the car. And then he said to me, he says, "Well, what color is it?" I didn't know the color of the car. And so anyway, he helped me find the car, and he let me drive home, drive on these freeway. I got where I was going. But anyway, but the thing about that, years later, I thought about that, and I also thought about, I used to live in the city, you know, like coming home once on a subway and very drunk on the subway, and a man helping me find my apartment. And when I think about these things, I am so grateful that those were honorable men, and because something really horrible could have happened to me. I could have been thrown in that car in California and nobody ever heard from me again or what have you. And the truth is that really horrible things do happen to alcoholics. It really does. And we do horrible things too. We're not bad people, but when we drink, we lose our judgment. And, you know, we don't wake up in the morning thinking that, gee, you know, I'm going to go out in my car today. I'm going to get drunk, get out in my car, and kill somebody and wind up in jail tonight. And so drunk, I don't even remember this. But this is what happens. You know, we don't intend to do these things, but we do these things. And thank God that there's a place that we can come to that helps us so we don't have to do these. These are not inevitabilities in our lives. These are just choices. And for me, coming here and speaking, for me today, not having a drink is all a matter of choice. AA is the greatest volunteer group in the world. You know, we volunteer to come here. How I got here was that I drank like that for a number of years, and then suddenly I just realized, I kept trying to make it better. I kept trying, like, this time I'm going to drink normally, or drink like my friend Barbara, and time again, I just couldn't do it. Just couldn't drink normally, and I never thought I was an alcoholic because I used to go on diets, for example, and I wouldn't drink for months once. I didn't drink for 3 months, and I was fine. I really was. But the whole time I was on that diet, I was thinking about what I was going to drink when I was off the diet. I swear, I used to think, not the chocolate cake, but like, I'm going to bottle of champagne, celebrate off the diet. And so anyway, I was married at the time, and my husband and I had some friends over for dinner on a particular day, and I wasn't going to have anything to drink, and then I decided just to have one. And it was a disaster. It was just a disaster of a day. You know, we all pretty much have the same story in AA. We drank as much as we could for as long as we could for whatever that was, and if we're lucky, we show up here. And that's what happened to me. And my husband was very disgusted with me. It's funny because the last drink I had was on August 6, 1978, and I had no idea when I woke up that morning that that was going to be the last day I drank. None at all. But when I woke up the following day on August 7th, 1978, the light was streaming into the bedroom, and I thought, you got to do something about this. Now, coming to AA was not what I had in mind. I really thought that there was a place that I could go to where I would learn how to drink normally. I really did. And I think there are places like that that exist. Thank God they didn't when I came in, because my drinking I just would have become worse. You know, so I came to AA, and I actually called up the Northern Westchester Council on Alcoholism, because I thought, well, maybe they knew one of these places. And I sat with a counselor that day, and she told me her story. And she was in AA, and she didn't say to me, Eileen, you should go to AA, but I knew that's where she was leading. And I asked her, I said, are there any alternatives to AA? And she said, you could see a psychiatrist. And I knew I knew that even though I was doing crazy things, I wasn't crazy. Really, that I had a problem with this drinking. Somehow I knew that much, that the problems that I was having, all the trouble that I was experiencing had to do with this drinking. So I went to the AA meeting, and I never drank again. But the obsession to alcohol was pretty much lifted. And that's the thing that really made me concerned when I was drinking, because even though I wasn't drinking all the time, I didn't drink every day necessarily, I thought about it almost every moment of my life. I was thinking about drinking all the time. I had a full-blown mental obsession about alcohol. And I came into AA, and for some reason, I mean, I know it was the higher power, God just lifted this obsession. But I was left with another obsession. That was, am I really an alcoholic? I couldn't believe that I could be an alcoholic. I had a good job. I had a good home. I had friends. I had a lot of good things. And the fact that the fabric of my life was slowly disintegrating, I didn't see that. But I couldn't see how I could be alcoholic. Drinking too much, yes, but alcoholic. Couldn't get it. And for 2 months, this drove me crazy. And I was working on 57th Street, right off of 6th Avenue, that way. and for some reason, in early October, I decided to go to a meeting. And this was unusual. I didn't usually do this during the day. And I walked over, because I was going to meetings in Westchester, I walked over to the Citicorp building on 53rd Street and Lexington Avenue, and I went to a meeting there. I got there late, and it was a discussion meeting, and there was a woman sitting there, and she was a beautiful, beautiful woman. She had, she was an older woman, probably in her about 70, but she was just so dignified and so beautifully dressed, and I was really impressed with her. And she told her story, and it was one of the worst stories I've ever heard. And what she said was, she had been a model for many years in Europe, and she said, towards the end of her story, she said, I wound up living in New York City and selling all of, she was a terrible alcoholic, very, very sick, and she said, I sold all of my paintings, all of the jewels, all of the furs, everything, they all went, everything. I never changed my clothing. I wore the same dress almost every day, and there was stuff from every part of her body covered her. She hardly ever saw anyone. And she said that one day, every day, in this particular day, she called up the liquor store for the alcohol to come to be delivered. And the doorbell rang, and she said, I crawled across the floor and reached up and opened the door, and she said, and I will never forget the look of revulsion on the delivery boy's face when I begged him to open the bottle, because I didn't have the strength to do it. Now, I have to tell you that my life wasn't even close to that. I wasn't anywhere near that. But I knew that as I know it at this moment, that was me. That was me. And it's still me. And that what I was being given was this great choice that I could either stay with this thing called AA and see what happens, or I could go out and something awful happen. That would happen to me, or something just as awful. And I never forgot this, of course. It's many years later, and I remember this as though it happened yesterday. And when the meeting was over, I stood up and we said the Lord's Prayer, and I started to cry. And I cried all the way. I walked back to the office. I was in tears that God loved me this much that he gave me this. And he loves us that much that he gave us this. And that we don't have to wind up like that. And if we wind up like that, it's because we made the choice to do it. And, you know, you never know when you speak who you're helping. And she never knew either. And years later, I decided I wanted to find her, and she had passed away. She actually, her name was Tommy, and she had was one of the people who had started the Lenox Hill Group. She's a great woman, and she has no idea how that she changed my life. So I went to meetings, and, you know, I got sober. And my life has been okay. I'm an okay person today. And I've learned many things about alcohol since I've been in. Like, for example, you know, you hear people stand up, and you'll hear a story like mine where somebody drank normally, and then all of a sudden they're alcoholic. And then other people stand up. You know, I had a drink when I was 15, loved it, got drunk every time. 30 years later, still getting drunk, came to AA, and. You know, it says in the big book, in the doctor's opinion, that we have an allergy to alcohol, and that's exactly what it is. It's an allergy. And just like any other allergy, sometimes, you know, you eat the strawberry when you're 5 years old and you break out into the hives, and then you're, you know, 32 and you're eating a strawberry shortcake and here come the hives. You know, it's the same thing. It's whenever, how many you have, what the sensitivity in your body is. I mean, there is a physical part of this. It's a mental obsession and a physical compulsion to drink. And that's what I learned. That's why I was okay when I was on those diets and I wasn't drinking. I wasn't getting drunk. Duh. You know, because I wasn't drinking. But if I start drinking again, you know, I will, I'll get drunk. I will want more. I will want more. I always wanted more. And the reason I don't drink today is because, one of the reasons is because there isn't enough in the world for me. Just isn't. I could have all the champagne in the world and I'd still want more. There just isn't enough for me. Whatever it is that tells normal people that they've had enough, I don't have that. I just don't. You know, it's gone. Just don't have it. I went out to dinner a few years ago with my friend George, and after the dinner, the waitress gave us these complimentary drinks, and he knows I'm an AA. He said, I'm not going to drink that, and he hardly drinks anyway. And he says, well, I wouldn't drink it. Now, I wouldn't drink it because it had alcohol, and there was I have an allergy to alcohol. And George wouldn't drink it because amaretto, and George has an allergy to nuts. And we couldn't drink that for different reasons, but there was a difference. I mean, a nut would kill him, literally. It could kill him in minutes. I'd have a slow death. And the other thing is that when George found out that he had the allergy to nuts, he was saying, like, well, maybe if I try filberts, or maybe Brazil nuts, you know, or almonds, hey, you know, what do we do? I did it. It's wine, you know, I'll drink vodka, you know, or you know, have beer, or, you know, only drink on, and we do this, it says in the big book that we do this. And, you know, I'm sober because there's a program of recovery here. And when I really understood that, you know, my sobriety really became more solid. It tells us in the big book that the program, and we heard it today, the program of recovery of these 12 steps, and it's just not enough for me to come to meetings, you know, and not drink. That's something, it's a lot, but it's not enough. That's not what's going to make me sober. What makes me sober are these 12 steps. And it's sort of, the analogy is sort of like sitting in a hospital room or sitting in the hospital. You're in the emergency room, you're in the right place, but unless you're taking the medicine, unless we're doing what the doctor tells us, we're not going to get well. this is how we get well, these 12 steps. And when I sponsor people, I do it like I go through this. We do them pretty quickly. You know, I don't mean like in a week, but you know, within a year, do the, you know, because that's how you recover. We have a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, and that's how it works for us. You know, I've never heard, for as long as I've been AA, I've never heard anybody stand up here and say, gee, I'm really sorry I came in when I did, you know. I wish I had been out there longer, you know. I never, ever heard that. What I've heard is people say, no, gee, you know, I came here and I went out again, and it wasn't good. Or, you know, I knew I had a problem and it took me years and years, and, you know, geez, if I only had found this, I'd only come here a few years ago, you know, wouldn't that have been a great thing, you know? Never heard that. This is a great place to be. And in all the years that I've been in AA, I've never wanted to have a drink except for one time when my father was dying. I was in AA about a year, not quite a year and a half. And well, I got a call from my mother. My father was in the hospital, and he died in within a week. And the day before he died, and I knew he was going to die, he was in intensive care, and the onset of this thing was very, very fast. And so I went home. I was living in Katona, and my father was there out on Long Island. I was driving on the Bronx River Parkway to my house. Actually, the Hutchinson River Parkway. It's important for me to say that. And I started to cry, and I was sobbing and sobbing. I shouldn't have even been driving. I was driving home to get clothes and to come back. And I was really hysterical. I shouldn't have been behind a wheel. And all of a sudden, I thought about my house in the woods and the light coming in and the blue armchair in the sunroom. And I thought of, gosh, sitting there with a drink. Because we had alcohol in the house. My husband drank. He was an alcoholic. And we always agreed that if it was a problem, we'd get it out. And it never had been. I was driving there, and I start thinking about sitting in this chair with a glass in my hand. And gradually, but very quickly, I started to feel better. I stopped crying. I calmed down. I felt okay. Just the thought of a drink did that for me. That's how powerful it is, just the thought of the drink. I started to almost meditate on this drink. I'm driving, and all I can do is think about this one drink that I'm going to have, the one drink. I mean, the insanity of the second step isn't the crazy stuff that we do. The insanity of the second step is thinking that we can drink normally. That's what's crazy. And I was insane going home, thinking that I would have one drink, and I would be okay. And I don't know where, but somewhere on the Hutchinson River Parkway, a car came right in front of mine. And on the back of this car, it said, one day at a time, and this too shall pass. I know God sent me that. God put that there. And I went home, and I got the clothes, and I was able the next day to minister my father on his deathbed and be there with him. And I was really, really afraid because I was praying for knowledge of God's will. And when you have somebody dying in your life, you just want to do something. You want to make it better. And I walked in that room, the hospital room that day, and I was a nervous wreck. And all of a sudden, all those prayers just kicked in. And I knew exactly what I was supposed to do. In fact, there was something that only I could do. Nobody else in the world could do this. I could be my father's daughter. I could be my father's daughter. And just being there with him and holding his hand, that was enough. And if I had sat in that chair that day and drank, none of that would have happened. And this is what AA gives us. It gives us great service and possibility. My life is wonderful. It really is. I mean, not every day is wonderful. This is wonderful. I have a lot of wonderful in my life. I've had times during my years of sobriety where things have happened, and I said, I didn't get sober for this to happen. I just didn't get sober for this to happen. But the truth is, I did get sober for it to happen. I got sober to experience life. you know, and experience it on whatever happens. And, you know, sometimes life is just awful. There are days where I, you know, I think, geez, you know, I don't want to get out of bed, or this is really awful. And I have some days like that, not many, but they happen to me. You know, it's life. These things happen. Most days are fine, and a lot of days are wonderful. And if it wasn't for AA, I wouldn't have any wonderful in my life. When I have a bad day, I'm comparing it to a lot of good ones. And if I was drinking, I wouldn't have anything to compare the days with. They would all be gray. So anyway, this is a wonderful, wonderful thing for me. I'm honored to be here. I'm always honored to be in an AA meeting. I do a lot of service. I pick up a broom. I do everything. I speak. I sponsor people. I make coffee. That's how I stay sober. I'm so happy to be speaking here, on an occasion that marks the anniversary of AA. The history of this program is unbelievable, and I encourage you to go outside if you haven't done it and buy those books, because it's unbelievable what's happened. And I just have so much gratitude to Bill and Bob and all the pioneers in the beginning who worked so hard for so many years with such little success. And look at the success we have today all over the world. And we're part of that legacy. We are the history of AA. And we're also the future of it and the present. Thank you, and God bless you so much.
By chance, if you can't give and can't put anything in the basket, don't be embarrassed. You know, for real, you're in the right place. Because I remember I used to come to a lot of meetings. Or I would choose not to come to the meeting just because when the basket was passed, I might not be able to put something in it. Or that would be the opportune time to run to the bathroom. You know, it's okay. You know, it's truly okay. You know. Okay, our next speaker is Dolores M. She's from the High Noon Group in Manhattan.
Hi, everybody. My name's Dolores, and I'm an alcoholic. And this morning, I woke up to a great miracle. It's been going on for quite a while, but I woke up and I was sober. And gosh, I never thought that would happen to me. I liked what Eileen was saying about, you know, life is kind of up and down and here and there, and that there's a lot of wonderful in it, and there's a lot of other stuff too sometimes, but you know, sometimes life sucks, but in AA it only sucks a day at a time. And I was born in the Midwest someplace, exactly where I don't know. I'm adopted, and I never did find out exactly where I was born, but I was adopted by a family very shortly after, a couple of months, 3 months, something like that. Can you hear me okay? It seems so weird. Anyway, the family that adopted me, I guess my dad used to talk about some relatives he had who were drunks, but my immediate family, my dad, he kept a bottle of whiskey in the back porch, and he called it his corn picking whiskey. We lived on a farm, and he'd have a couple of shots every harvest period, and that was it. I mean, he just didn't drink. When I came along, started my drinking. The bottle went down a little faster. But I saw my mother drink once, and I was real glad I never saw it happen twice. But so I don't know, you know. But anyway, the alcohol played no part in our family life. And you know, I don't know where it came from for me, but I remember I was in junior high. And I was on what we called a booster trip. Our town was having a carnival, and we were going around announcing it to all the towns, and the band was playing and stuff, and people were drinking, and they asked me if I wanted a beer, and I said yeah, and I started my career of drinking that day, and I drank until I blacked out and passed out, and I think I got sick when I came to that time. I'm not sure. Excuse me 1 minute.
Does anybody have a clock, a watch? I can't see this. Okay.
Anyway, that started it. And I was living in this small town, 750 people, and you don't do a lot that the whole world doesn't know about. So I had to kind of keep it under wraps a bit. I guess maybe I was a periodic for a few years, but whenever I had a chance, I drank. I've been a musician as far back as I can remember. I mean, I wasn't a musician, I guess, when I was seven, but I started studying piano. And I also played the trumpet, and there was a period of time where I went up to this town called Sioux City to study trumpet with a guy. And my brother would drive us up, and when I was having my trumpet lesson, he'd drive over into South Dakota and pick up a bottle of something. And I'd have taken the mutes out of my trumpet case, and we'd put the bottle in that and come home with this bottle of booze. But my brother went in for stuff like Mogan David wine and slow gin, and God, I mean, it was really terrible. Anyway, I think I understood completely the first time I heard that saying about, you know, I didn't get in trouble every time I drank, but every time I got in trouble, I had been drinking. And that started happening for me. And just sort of one mess after another. I remember once being on a date with this guy, and we went to some party, and I got very drunk, and I got sick. And I don't guess I blacked out, because I do kind of, well, maybe I did, I don't know, in and out the whole night. On the way home, we stopped in a cornfield and did stuff I was none too proud of. And I can remember as we crested the hill driving down to where I lived, I thought, God, if I just hadn't gotten so drunk, I wouldn't have done any of this stuff. You know, and all through my drinking history, there were those times where I was aware that, I was aware without being aware that drinking was playing a sort of bad part in my life. I remember near the end of my drinking, decided to drink by the pint because for some reason, not knowing I had a drinking problem, but I did not want to be a quart a day drinker. So I figured the easy way to do this is, you know, buy a pint at a time and you can keep track. And when I'd been sober about 6 months, I was invited to an AA dinner party given by somebody at one of the groups I went to. And we got to talking about quantity. And I was absolutely mortified to discover there are only 2 pints in a quart instead of 4. So anyway, I graduated from high school, and I got out of that little dinky town, and I went down to Des Moines, Iowa, and I went to a college there, Drake University. And I was a piano major and a trumpet minor, and what I really majored and minored and everything else in was booze. I found people who drank. I just gravitated towards them. There was a chap that worked in a restaurant someplace, and he had a green Cadillac convertible, and we called it the Green Bitch. And a bunch of us, why I don't know, but a bunch of us would get together every afternoon and go driving around all the little small towns in Iowa. And we'd play the pinball machines, and if you got a certain score, you won a six-pack of beer. So we never had to buy beer. You know, we got very, very good at the pinball, kept getting our free beer. And, you know, I don't know what I did in college. I mean, I know I wasn't flunking out, but I was no A student either. I know that my music was good, my piano work and my trumpet work. I even actually joined a dance band, Marie Monday's all-girl band, and we played gigs around town and places. And even then, when we, you know, we'd do a set and then have a break, and everybody else in the band would go get a beer and not me. Somehow I knew I didn't dare start. You know, another one of those little, it's like somebody always was trying to point something out to me, but I never got it. Anyway, I just went, got in one mess after another. As I started to say, my music work was real good, and I wasn't flunking out, but my life was a mess. And there, one of the things, actually, that was happening was I was hanging out with a gay crowd of people. I was dating a black guy that was a music major. And I was drunk every day. And this is the early 50s in Des Moines, Iowa, and it didn't cut it. But things went sort of from bad to worse, and I was at a party one night, and unfortunately I had signed out at the dorm. If we were already out, we'd, you know, we just would come home when it was time, but I had been there and signed out, so I had to get back to sign in. So I had somebody drive me from this party. I ran in, I signed in, I went like I was going up to my room, and I went downstairs instead and left and went back to the party. And I knew that someone had seen me, and I figured they were going to turn me in, but I just didn't give a darn. And sure enough, they did. They asked me, I was given two options. I could be thrown out of the school right then and there, or I could be campused for the rest of the year. So I asked them how many days were left of school, and there were 3 weeks, and I said, okay, I'll be campused. And that summer, a letter came to my parents, and I had gone down to get the mail that day, and it was from dear old Drake University, and I just knew what it was going to say. And it did. It asked me not to darken their door again. The other thing that happened to me during my stay at Drake University was I got shipped off to a psych ward in Omaha, Nebraska, and locked up for a few months. Now, they said it was all sorts of things, but what it really was I was a drunk. And oddly enough, it was never, nobody ever said much to me about drinking. It was weird. I'd get a day pass, go out and get blind drunk and come back. They'd throw away the key and lock me up again. Anyway, all this stuff had gone on, and there I was home for the summer, and I didn't know what I would do, and I could not get accepted into any other college. And when I was in Des Moines, there was one point where I was living off campus, and I was working in a music store. I guess it was when I came back from being in the nut house, and I didn't go to, I missed a semester of school or something. And I met this guy working in a record shop, and that summer, I can't remember whether he sent me a telegram or called or wrote a letter or what, but by some strange way, we communicated. And he said, let's go to New York and get married, and we'll please our families, and we'll have a ball. And he was in Florida. He'd gotten kicked out of Des Moines, Iowa. I just got kicked out of Drake, but he made it out of the whole town. And he thought we were going to come to New York and live on Daddy's money, and Daddy had loads and loads of money. And a friend of his in Des Moines wrote him this letter, just ripping me apart from one end to the other. And his father, who had never done such a thing in his life, intercepted the letter and promptly disowned his son. So we came to New York. My family, who always did the same thing if it was important, it just went in the don't discuss file. They never discussed anything about it. His family disowned him, and here were the two of us. And why we got married is absolutely beyond me. We ruined a perfectly good friendship by getting married. And we didn't have to get married. Who would have ever known, you know? And Bob smoked pot, and I drank. And he also had a fierce allergy. And I've never known anybody so allergic to work as that man was. It just wasn't working, you know. I mean, he wasn't working and I wasn't. Anyway, things were falling apart to begin with, you know. So I went to Mexico and got a divorce. And in the meanwhile, a friend of mine had rented a piano for me and had it delivered where I was living. Where we were all living. Bob and I had moved in with three fellows in a place on East 6th Street, and we had this crazy apartment where we all lived, $15 a week from everybody, and it paid the rent and bought the food and the whole thing, you know. And the only problem was my husband Bob and the guy whose apartment it was every week put in an IOU, and the other three of us paid our $15. But anyway, this friend had rented me a piano, and I started studying again, and I thought I'd try to go back to school here in New York. So I got the divorce. I moved up to 74th Street, East 74th Street, which is, I don't think, of course I wouldn't know because I was just drunk all the time, but there weren't many young people in that building when I was living there anyway. But after I got sober, it turns out that 414 East 74th Street is full of AAs, and I go by it every once in a while and remember some rather horrible things that happened to me when I was there, but it's nice to know all those AAs are there. Anyway, I got the divorce. I moved up to 74th Street, And I started studying, and I took an entrance exam, and I got accepted into school in New York, where they didn't seem to give a darn who I ran around with or how much I drank or anything else. They didn't really care about anything except just play the piano well. Now, you could get in and get out. Getting in was hard, and getting out was harder, but I made it. You know, I graduated from that school, and I don't know how, because my life at this point was happening, but I wasn't present for it. I mean, I'd show up about 5 minutes a day and be there, and then the rest of the time was just sort of a gray out all the time. I finally graduated from school, and in the meanwhile, I had moved to Mount Vernon with a friend, and we lived in her parents' house, and they had a two-family house, and that was a big mistake, but anyway, the first night we were up there, we invited some friends up, and we all got plastered, and one of the guys fell down the stairs, and our name was Mud from then on, or at least mine was. But anyway, I was living up there, and I graduated, and I thought, gosh, you know, the problem with my life is that I'm stuck up here in Mount Vernon, and all my friends live in Manhattan. Well, I had about two friends left, but the real problem was I was driving back and forth from Mount Vernon to New York every night, getting just blind drunk in New York, and then trying to get home, and it was really getting very, very dangerous. I had started teaching before I graduated. I'd go to people's houses to give the kids piano lessons. And the mothers in these families were all wonderful. You know, if it was a hot day, they'd say, "How about a cold beer?" And I, of course, said yes. And then if it was cold, they'd say, "Why don't you stay for dinner and let's have martinis when my husband will be home soon, we'll eat." You know, it was a drink fest. And I don't know what kind of teaching I did. It must have been a mess. It just defies wondering. But I was just drunk all the time. You know, that was my life somehow. Where's the next drink going to come from? Sometimes now I just almost can't believe it. It seems like whoever that was is somebody I don't know anymore, which is one of the reasons I usually say yes if I'm asked to speak, because I don't ever want to forget all that. And I don't ever want to be there again. But anyway, I just thought it was too grisly living up there, so I moved back into New York, and I started my final descent to the bottom, and it was a pretty fast go. It took 3 years, but it still was straight down. And I got a job in an office, and then a friend of mine who was teaching a lot in Forest Hills went off to Paris to study and asked me if I'd like his class of students, and I said, yeah. So I was going out to Forest Hills and teaching, and I quit the full-time job and just worked I worked from 9 to 2, I think. And then I'd go out there, and guess what? All the mothers were exactly the same. The beer, the martinis, the whatever, it flowed freely. And what I can remember of that, I don't know, must have been horrible. Anyway, finally, it reached the point where I couldn't wait to get back into New York to have a drink, so I started buying one of my pints on the way in and drinking on the train. As I said, the mothers were plying me with booze, and my life was really getting worse and worse. And it wasn't just teaching, it was like all the time. I was just always drunk or drinking or looking for the next drink. And finally, all of this excessive work just got too much, so I quit the office part of it. And that way I could get up in the morning and I could drink and I could black out, pass out and black out, and come to and still get it together in time to get out there and teach. But it was just, the cops were always around too. I'd go out to dinner, and the next thing I'd know, I'd be out in the street, and the police all over the place, and everybody yelling and screaming and talking. I never did know what went on. I have no idea. I came to one night. I came out of a blackout, and I was handcuffed to the banister of the building next door to me, and I never found out what that was all about either. The police were all around, and I took a dim view of that, and they took a dimmer one, and they hauled me off to a place called Knickerbocker Hospital, and I don't think it is in existence anymore. I don't know, but anyway. There was one of those gurneys, they call them, with the wheels, you know. I just crawled up on one of those and went to sleep. And a little while later, some guy was talking to me. It was probably a doctor. He was probably discussing booze. I don't know. Next thing, I was on the bus going home. And life just went on like that. And again, Eileen was talking about various gentlemen who were kind to her. And one night, I was asleep in the car, and there was somebody rattled the window, you know, and opened the door. And this guy said, "What are you doing here?" I said, "Well, I'm sleeping, you know." And he said, "Well, where do you live?" And I told him. And he said, "Well, do you have the keys to your apartment?" I said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, give them to me." So I gave him the keys. He said, "Come on." He walked me home. He took me, you know, inside the first door that just opens. And then he unlocked the door to my building, handed me my keys, said, "What floor do you live on?" I told him, on top. And he said, "I'm going to wait right here until I hear you shut the door, and don't ever do this again." And, you know, that scenario, I'm very sure, was supposed to be ended a little differently than that. Wish I knew who that guy was. I'd sure like to thank him. At any rate, I also did something. I don't know what it was. I had a couple attempts at taking too many pills, but I think that was after I was in therapy. Something went wrong, and I discovered, I went over to Metropolitan Hospital, to the walk-in psychiatric clinic, and there was a guy on duty that night. He was an intern, I guess you call it. His name was Dr. Luniansky. And my friend of mine said, with a name like that, you got to be a shrink or nuts. And he was a wonderful shrink, and he nailed me right away. He knew what was wrong with me. And I actually saw him for 3 years, 2 years before I came into the program, and then 1 year after. And then he got drafted, and that ended that. But I owe him a lot for just hammering away at me about my drinking. You know, everything was awful. Cops all over the place all the time, me not knowing what was going on. I went once with a friend to go shopping over on the east side, and we drove clear over from Central Park West to Lexington Avenue or something, and to go shopping. And we got out of the car, and she said, "Oh, look at that nice bar. Let's just go have one drink, and then we'll, you know." And I don't know what happened, but when I went into that bar, it's like, you know, one of those things in a movie, a flashback or a flash forward or something. I knew what was wrong. I thought, "Oh my God, if I go in here, I'm going to have a drink, and I won't be able to stop, and this day will be a mess." And I couldn't live with that, so I rushed in and had a drink. You know, and it went on like every other day. Finally, it was I also, this friend that I was handcuffed to the banister of the apartment, she had a bar, and I tried to build one in my apartment. I never could keep it stocked, so I gave up. But I did a lot of drinking down at her bar. And she had a couple of dogs, and I had a dog, and she had one of those swinging doors, and they could go out in the garden. So I'd go out, walk the dog at night, and be too drunk to get home, so I'd just crash down at her pad. Anyway, I got in a fight with her one night, and I don't remember anything about it, but she broke her ankle. I fell on her and broke her ankle very badly. And I came to, I was in Central Park driving with Mimi in the back seat, and some guy I'd never seen before sitting in the front seat begging me to let him drive. And I lived on 82nd Street, and so did Mimi, right off Central Park West. And it took me 2 hours to get from there to Roosevelt Hospital. It was sheer madness. About 3 years ago, it occurred to me that in some of my blackouts, I wasn't the demure little sit in the corner and drink drunk. I guess you figure that out by now. But I could have killed someone, you know, and I never would have known it. And I've heard so many stories about guys in prison, and probably women too, you know, they killed somebody, they don't even remember it. Well, anyway, it went from bad to worse, and it was December, and everybody, all the mothers called in the morning to tell me that the kids all had the flu or whatever bug was going around. I thought, "Oh, great, I'll do something really constructive," and I ordered my first pint. And, you know, the day got away from me just like every other day. I remember that afternoon, I was out in the street, and I was on my way home, and I thought, "Geez, maybe I'll go upstairs and I'll I'll lay down and take a nap, and maybe one of two things. Maybe I'll wake up and I'll be sober, or maybe I'll wake up and I'll drink and I can get drunk. Because alcohol had completely let me down. It didn't work anymore. I was in some sort of never land, not drunk, not sober. I don't know what I did that night, because I don't remember anything. I'm sure I went out and got drunk and blacked out and the whole thing. The next morning I came to, and I was down at my friend's, the one with the bar, and there was my dog. So I probably did the same thing. I just couldn't make it back up the stairs to my apartment. Crashed there. And for some reason, known only to God, I guess, I called AA. And I'll never ever know why. I mean, just out of the blue, I dialed AA. Actually, it was the line was busy the first time, and I remember thinking, well, I went back and stood by the bar, and I thought, I'll give them one more try, and if nobody, you know, if they're still busy, I'll have a drink and decide what to do about this. And it wasn't still busy. And I talked to some lady who, I don't know how it's possible to know through the phone wire if somebody's had a bath that day, but I was pretty sure she had, and that her clothes were clean and her hair was probably washed. And she seemed very articulate. She ended the conversation, told me to go to Regency that night. It was on 85th and Park, and how to get there and all that, and ended her part of the conversation. She said, you know, just remember we're all drunks. And I was just blown away. And that was when the miracle happened. It took me a few years to figure this one out, too. But when I got to the meeting that night, for the first time in my life, I knew I was at the right place at the right time with the right people. That had never happened to me before. I'd never belonged any place that I was. But you know, that wasn't the miracle. It happened when I hung up the phone from speaking to that woman. The first thought in my head, and that's another one of those little remember something things, was, I can't drink today. I'm going to an AA meeting. Where did that come from? Since I was 18, I had been drinking daily. I was 35. And suddenly I'm not going to drink? You know, I didn't. I'll never know how that worked either. But I went to the meeting that night, and I loved it. And I kept coming back. And I finally quit a job out in Valley Stream so I could go on Wednesdays, I think it was, or something. Anyway, everything went fine, and then I got into a fearsome pity party all by myself. And I was just madder than a wet hen. I was furious with AA. Don't ask me why. I have absolutely no idea. But it became extremely important to me that every one of you knew how angry I was, so I canceled my subscription to the Grapevine. And, you know, I've always been eternally grateful that I didn't cancel my subscription to sobriety, and I didn't. And I called a friend of mine. I said, can you take me back to the meetings? I somehow couldn't do it by myself, and he said sure. And you know, when you get sober, life sets in, and it's incredible. You know, I mean, and I've had job problems and relationship problems and health problems and money problems and problems with problems, you know, but I've also had some of the most incredible, exquisite, just marvelous, there aren't enough adjectives to tell, wonderful things happen in my life. And one of the greatest things is that I'm present for my own life, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent. Now I know what's going on. It's incredible. You know, if all I ever got was that I'm sober, that would be more than I ever expected. But as you know, when you start working the steps and get a sponsor and start sponsoring, you get the whole ball of wax. It's called life, and thank God I got it, and thank you so very much.
Don is from the Bay Ridge Group in Brooklyn.
Good afternoon, friends. I'm an alcoholic, and my name is Don.
Hey, Don.
I almost slipped and gave my last name. I have to tell you, tomorrow is my 83rd birthday. So I want to warn you all to sit back and relax. I'm going to give all the details of all those 83 years. Relax. As a friend of mine said, I should start with my social drinking. And that lasted for about 10 minutes. It was problems after that. And I even told him I was going to tell his story. At any rate, there were a lot of people here that I said hello to during the break. Some of them were people from my home group and from some groups in the area, and some friends from upstate. I lived upstate, Bloomingburg, New York. I lived up that way for about 20 years, and some of the friends were from there, too. And I thought, gee, isn't this wonderful? All these people came to give me the support to keep me going. And you know what they said to me? We're just here to check up on you to see if you're going to sell the same story here that you tell at home. That's what I have to put up with. I usually characterize myself as having come into AA at the age of 31 going on 14. Now you know, 14 emotionally, 34 chronologically. I never grew up. Never grew up. Early drinking, and I say 14, that's arbitrary. I'm sure it was before that. But I can recall different incidents. I don't remember a lot of terrible incidents, and there's a good reason for that, too. Somewhere, either still 16 or just 17, I had, as far as I know, the first blackout. And from that point on, if I didn't have a blackout, I wasn't drunk. I knew that. And you know I'm not an alcoholic. But I did have a little bit of trouble. I can remember probably about 18, leaving a gin mill about 2 o'clock in the morning, heading for home, and the next thing I remember is the sun is shining. And I'm sitting in a car in the middle of a vacant lot. And the car is in apparent good condition. And I don't own a car. I was a little nervous about that. I got out of that car and got away from there in a hurry, because if the cops ever caught up to me, I don't know what I would have told them. But that was the story of my life. Things like that. At 19, I joined the Navy. And from that point on, I really never lived home again. I always used it as a home address, but I never lived home again. I spent a few years in the Navy in World War II, and then after that I went back sailing on merchant ships. And it was while I was sailing on those merchant ships that I met the young lady who was the lady to become my wife. And I took her down to the ship to have dinner one time, and she thought this was great. And she induced me to promise that I would one day take her on a cruise if we got married. Well, it took something like 30 years, but we did make it. Slow. This is the way things went. What kind of a drinker was I? And I hear people talk about the different kind of drinkers they are. And the only thing I could figure out, and I'm still confused with it, is I was a daily drinker who got drunk weekly and went on periodic binges. I don't know what that makes me. I have no idea. But you know, I didn't have a problem with alcohol. I drank a little too much once in a while. And I mentioned my wife, and we had a wonderful courtship. It lasted for about 2 years. And we went to a lot of nice places and did a lot of wonderful things, and we had a heck of a lot of fun. But I always made sure I got her home early enough so I could go out and do the serious drinking. So she never knew how my drinking was. She never knew anything about it. And of course, you knew what was going to happen. We were going to get married, I'd stop drinking, we'd walk off into the sunset hand in hand and live happily ever after. Somehow or other, it didn't happen that way. I don't know why. But of course now, I couldn't take her home and go out because that was my home too. That created a problem. And she'd always ask those stupid wifely questions. Don't you think you had enough? Don't you think it's time to go home? So you know what happened. I started going out alone. She stayed home. And one of these trips out alone, I came home, I don't know, 10 o'clock at night. She and my mother-in-law were sitting in the living room looking at the boob tube. And my wife said to me, come downstairs, I want to talk to you. Now, honestly, I have no idea what she said. I don't know how long she talked. It's probably a long time. The only thing I can tell you about it is that the ultimatum came. You know, you hear all these people that were mandated to AA? This is where I was mandated. Either go to AA or get the hell out. And you know I'm not an alcoholic. And that was the way I started in AA. There was another time during this period of time, I came home and my wife again asked me those stupid wifely questions. Where were you? Who were you with? And what did you do? And I told her the truth. I told her I don't remember. And she screamed at me, you've got to remember. What do you mean you don't remember? Never made that mistake again. Anytime she asked after that, I had a story to tell her, and I had some good stories. I think they were pretty good because she believed some of them. But at any rate, that's how I started in AA. And I believed what I heard in AA. I believed all of the speakers, and I thought it was wonderful for them. I'm not an alcoholic. I don't need this. Maybe I drink a little too much once in a while, but not that much. And I kept going. And I'd love to tell you that I kept going because I was impressed by what I saw and what I heard. The truth of the matter is that I was going because this was my escape from home. Home was a very unhappy place for me to be, and I didn't want to be there. And this is a way I could get out without having another fight. And that's what kept me going to meetings. When did I make that change from believing I was not an alcoholic to accepting the fact that, hey, maybe I do have a little trouble with alcohol? I don't know. Honestly, I don't know. But I kept going. And little by little, I listened. And now, instead of comparing, I was starting to identify. Gee, that happened to me. And yes, it didn't make any difference who the speaker was. I could identify with most, if not all. And little by little, I was beginning to accept it and beginning to recognize that I belonged here. This is where I belonged. And I can remember very clearly, and it was before I made that decision, my wife and I taking a ride down the Bell Parkway and parking in one of those parking areas along the Bell Parkway. And the reason we were doing this is that we wanted to have a talk. And you couldn't possibly have a talk in my house. My mother-in-law lived with us. I had the three noisiest kids in the neighborhood and this damn nagging wife. Wouldn't you drink under these circumstances? That's why I drank. And you know the strange thing about that is that I can't even remember any of them individually or as a group ever sitting on my chest and pouring a drink down my throat. I was the one that was doing that. And now when I was beginning to understand that maybe I am an alcoholic, I was beginning to understand that the only one who could stop was me. And then I stopped. And I thought, wow, the whole world's going to be great now. Everything's going to be fine. Things got worse. You see, now, all of the things that were going wrong in my life, I couldn't blame on alcoholism. And I had to begin accepting responsibilities. And I didn't like that. I didn't like accepting those responsibilities. And we built up a lot of space between my wife and I. We were married, we lived together, and yet we rarely, if ever, talked to each other. And it was, within a week after I went to my first meeting, she went to her first Al-Anon meeting. and she went to Al-Anon meetings. And she went to Al-Anon meetings all of her life from that point on. And I have to tell you, I'm convinced that had she not gone to Al-Anon, I probably would not have stayed sober. Yeah, it made a big difference. It made a very, very big difference in our lives. But I said that we were growing apart instead of growing together. And that went on for a few years. And a friend of ours, a couple that we knew, he was in AA, she was in Al-Anon, invited us to a couples meeting in Summit, New Jersey. Summit, New Jersey, that's a way out in the hinterland. But we went. We went once. And I was amazed at what I heard there. Because they were talking about us. The things that were happening in our lives were what they were talking about. A couple that I got to know quite well later on, she was talking about a particular incident, and out of the clear blue sky, when it came his turn to talk, he said, "I didn't know you felt like that." And that was what was happening in our life. Oh yeah, she talked. Theoretically, I listened, but I was so busy building up an answer that I never heard what she said. So there was no communication. But being basically lazy, we went back to Brooklyn and we started our own couples group. And it went very, very well for us. It really did. Now we became a couple again. Now we did things together. Now we really did hold hands. I had somebody tell me not so very long ago that they missed seeing my wife and I at an open meeting holding hands. Isn't that a wonderful way to be remembered? Yeah. She was a wonderful woman, and I'm very prejudiced anyway, but that's beside the point. She was. She really was. And then it reached a point where she had to be in a wheelchair, you know? And I told her, "This is my opportunity to push you around." And she laughed. She laughed. This is the relationship that developed from a couple that couldn't even talk together. It took time. We had to work on it and work at it. But it could happen, and it did happen. And we became friends. Imagine that. After all these years, we become friends again. Friends, lovers, confidants. Yeah, it could happen. But again, we had to work at it. And we found out that the primary problem was simply communication. And I think I heard Derek say this earlier, I'm pretty sure he did. God gave us two ears and one mouth. He wants us to listen twice as much as we talk, and that was my problem. I knew how to talk, didn't know how to listen though. And of course, when my wife said anything, who the hell pays any attention to her? Now I was beginning to start to listen. And life got better and better. And they offered us these 12 suggested steps. Wow. And I look at them, and I look at them today, and I look at them all the time. And I think about them. And it says in the third step that we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Why not? Why not get to know God better? That's what brought me here. You don't think it was anything I did that brought me here. My wife might have pushed me a little to help God, but that's what got me here. But it was God that brought me here. And recognizing how much God does for me each day, today, each day, gives me that kind of feeling that I want to do what I can as a means of expressing my gratitude to God. What can I do? I think the big thing I can do is try to learn as well as I can about these 12 suggested steps and try to live this way as best I can and take it out into my daily life. It can be done, and I try to do it. And it's wonderful that I have this opportunity to do it. A great feeling. Now, I was just thinking on the way over here today, I drove over. Am I crazy? What a mistake that was, but I got here anyway. And I was thinking on the way over here today, you know, here we have this auditorium with this many people and this wonderful day to celebrate what two men started 71 years ago. Yes, they did it for us. They did it for all of us. And when you think about it, at least I do, I think about the size of this crowd. But this is only the beginning. How many millions, and I'm using that millions in the plural, how many millions have been helped by this program? You think about that. And it's not any big group that goes out and does that. It's you. It's you, it's you, it's me. All of us, we do this to try to help the next person seeking help. And we try to help them by sharing our experience, strength, and hope, because that's what kept us alive. And I know that my experience is not going to be exactly the same as anybody else's. I recognize, and I hope you do too, that I am today the sum substance of all of my life's experiences, the good, the bad, the indifferent. All of this is part makes me what I am today. So that, yeah, there's going to be differences. But there's going to be a lot of similarities, too. And it's those similarities we look at. And we can look at each other and say, hey, this is what you did, and it worked for you. Maybe if I try it, it'll work for me too. And I keep trying to see if it'll work for me. I'd love to tell you that everything went perfectly well during all of these years. Well, my wife and I developed this wonderful friendship, and it's hard for me to even look back and think of how great it was. And then on September 8th, 2001, she passed away in her sleep. And I felt terrible loss. And yet, there wasn't that great feeling of loss because I could feel her spirit being with me. And the first day of her wake was September 11, 2001. Not only was that the first day of our wake, but it was also our 53rd wedding anniversary. And because of this, now at that particular period of time we were living upstate, our plan was a one-day wake upstate and a two-day wake in Brooklyn. Well, as a result of 2001, September 11th, that we couldn't get the body down in time for the wake in Brooklyn, so that it was one day up there and one day in Brooklyn, but we managed it. And I wondered, you know, and I often wondered, what she was doing during this wake, she was looking down and saying, I wonder what all this fuss is about. Isn't it wonderful? And that was the kind of a woman she was. She would enjoy that and recognize that we were so fortunate and so blessed. And I said before, my way of thanking God, trying to the best of my ability to live the way these 12 suggested steps offer me, the way they offer me. And I also think about, well, I'm going to AA. I'm going to meetings. Am I giving back what AA gives to me? You heard Clay talk about service. What can I do? I remember very clearly after I was in the group for, I don't know, a couple of years, they asked me if I would be chairman of the group. This was great for my ego. I don't know how good it was for the group, but it was great for my ego. And they waited until I said yes. Then they advised me that the most important job I had to take care of as chairman of the group was to make sure the garbage was empty after the meeting. I must have been well indoctrinated because I still do it. But the group still lets me come back. And I still feel a closeness with all the group and the people in it. And certainly the wonderful people that came here to listen. These people hear me all the time. Why would they come over here to hear me? Think I was going to say something different? That's what they were checking on. And I kept coming back. And I will keep coming back. Because I've come to learn that AA doesn't need me. If I want to stay sober and live this good life and enjoy the blessings that God gives me each day, I better keep going there and keep getting that help and keep sharing those thoughts and ideas and keep working and doing the things that keep the group going. Yes, it works. And I have to tell you, my wife taught me how to count my blessings, and I spend a lot of time every day counting my blessings. And she said very simply, you have two arms, you have two legs, you have two eyes, you have a nose, you have a mouth, and your own pretty good working order. You did absolutely nothing to deserve them. You have a lot to be grateful for. Yes, and I recognize I have a lot to be grateful for. And I keep enjoying the gifts that God gives me each day. He does give me those gifts each day. And before I came over here today, I said a little prayer. Prayer that God would help me to say what I should say, to do what I should do, and be what I should be. And I try. And I recognize that I don't have words. He puts the words in my mouth. And it keeps working as long as I'm willing to work at it. It's a wonderful life. And I recognize that each day God offers me his blessings. He has in the past, he is today, and he will also offer me these blessings in the future. As long as I am trying to the best of my limited ability to live the way I believe he wants me to live. Certainly he wants me to live to help and reach out in AA, but he also wants me to live and reach out to other people, to offer whatever I can to help others and to be part of that life. And I certainly want to thank you, and it's an honor and privilege to be here. I want to thank all of you for allowing me to be here. And thank God for another day.